So what we've done is we've gone through the first two of 26 reasons why Jews don't believe in Jesus. 26 reasons Jews don't believe in Jesus. And there's a few of you here tonight who weren't here on previous nights, so I'll explain to you the premise very quickly. The premise is that this is anti-missionary literature, meaning it's written to refute the gospel and to refute the New Testament, and to refute the claims of Christianity. It's written in defense of Judaism, and in response to the, what would you say, the missionary efforts of evangelical Christianity, for the most part. And so, it's written by Asher Norman. He's an Orthodox Jew and a lawyer. So, that's a little bit of an overview of the book. The idea of a class like this, you know, you might think, now why would believers want to study literature from an opposite perspective? And the idea is that we should know why we believe what we believe, and we shouldn't be afraid of learning other perspectives. And also, as we are challenged with some of these core questions, some of these deep questions that are raised as we work through this book. We haven't hit too much that's really been too earth-shaking so far, but we will. And as we are, you know, that will be an opportunity for us to investigate the scriptures ourselves further and see why it is we believe what we believe. Okay, so that's the premise. We've been through the first two reasons, and tonight we're going to knock out reason number three and reason number four, which I think should be a task easily accomplished because the reasons are very similar, and this is should not be difficult material for us. It should not raise too much objection for us in a Messianic congregation. Okay, reason number three is that the commandments of the Torah are eternal. Now let me explain why this is a reason that Jews don't believe in Jesus. And here's a quote from the book. He says, Mr. Norman says, Christian missionaries often assert that Jews are not required to keep God's laws because they, the laws that is, have been replaced by faith in Jesus. So the premise is that prior to the coming of Jesus, the Jewish people and the children of Israel had to keep the laws. But after the coming of Jesus, that's no longer the case. Now you need to believe in Jesus, and that believing in Jesus works as a substitute for obedience to God's laws. And so that's the problem that he's addressing here by saying, wait a second, that doesn't hold up because the commandments of the Torah are eternal. And so we're going to look at a series of passages rather quickly that he offers us. Exodus chapter 17, verse 9. God said further to Abraham, now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you, your descendants after you, throughout their generations. So Abraham's descendants, that's the seed of Abraham, that is the people, the children of Abraham is another way to say it. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. Okay, so first off the bat, he says, first thing we want to see here, Abraham and his children are supposed to be circumcised and keep God's covenant. Not just in Abraham's generation, but all of his descendants after him. Fine. Okay, let's grab another, Exodus 31. That one alone is a big deal, and I know why he put that one first. Because in Christianity, reading Paul, you could come to the conclusion that one of the first things to be tossed out is circumcision. That now circumcision is a circumcision of the heart, and is no longer a literal, necessary, physical thing. Needless to say, since we're studying Galatians, I suppose, needless to say, the issue with Paul and circumcision is not that he's abrogating circumcision for Jewish people. he's making a distinction between Gentiles and Jewish people. Okay, Exodus 31, verse 16 says, "So the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath, to celebrate the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the sons of Israel forever." So three great things here. Okay, first one is throughout their generations. So that means as long as there's generations of Jewish people, that the Sabbath is ongoing. Second is, it's a perpetual covenant. Perpetuity. And the third is the word forever. A sign between me and the children of Israel forever. So, Sabbath, why is he bringing this one up right after circumcision? Because the next thing you're going to hear from a Christian missionary is probably going to be that the Sabbath has been done away with or replaced by Sunday. Okay, so he's kind of on a track here. Deuteronomy 11:1. "You shall therefore love the Lord your God and always keep his charge, his statutes, his ordinances, and his commandments." So there's all the different kinds of laws that you would possibly find in the Torah. Charge, statutes, ordinances, commandments. And the point is that you are to always keep these. So yeah, and that's, I mean, I don't know why that particular verse over another, this is something that comes up again and again and again in the Torah, that the commandments are ongoing. That the Torah is not done away with, is not to be canceled, I should say. Deuteronomy 28 is the next one. We're just going to move through these pretty quick. 46, verse 46. What? "They shall become a sign and a wonder on you and your descendants forever." What shall? That's out of context. "These curses shall come on you and pursue you." All right. So, well, strike on that one. Strike that one off the list. But yeah, that one's out of context. But we get the point. And there's a lot more text than these. We could spend the whole evening looking at texts that say this very same thing. All right. One more. 29:28. It's 29:29 is supposed to be the reference. So I think there might be a numbering discrepancy. See, that's the deal. So it's a difference. You'll find this happens a lot between a Christian published Bible and a Jewish published Bible. There are discrepancies in the verse numbering systems. So. Okay, so the reference is, "The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things revealed," that is the Torah, what God has spoken, "these things belong to us and our sons forever." Why? "So that we may observe all the words of this law." So it's another reference that the Torah goes on forever, which is not, it's not that big of a deal. Why is he making such a big deal out of it? This, in fact, it's something that if you read the Bible, it's just da obvious, because it's repeated again and again and again, eternal statutes and so on and so forth. The reason that it's not da obvious, of course, is because we teach just the opposite in Christianity. Okay, so then he takes us out of the Torah into Psalm 111. This is fun. We're just doing a Bible study here. Psalm 111, verse 7. "The works of his hands are truth and justice. All his precepts are sure. They are upheld forever and ever. They are performed in truth and uprightness. He has sent redemption to his people. He has ordained his covenant forever." And his covenant, is the Torah is... The covenant is not the Torah. We need to make sure that we make that clear. The Torah is not the covenant. The covenant is not the Torah. The covenant of Israel is the agreement to keep the Torah. To keep the Torah. Because at that covenant ceremony, they say, Moses reads the Torah, and then they say, "Everything that the Lord has said, we will do." That's the covenant. But the Torah contains the covenant because it contains God's promises. So, he says, he has ordained his covenant forever. There you go. How about 2 Kings? Let's go see 2 Kings. This is like Bible drill, you know, sword drills. 2 Kings 17 and 37. The statutes and ordinances and the Torah, the law, and the commandment which he wrote for you, you shall observe to do forever. You shall not fear other gods. Okay, so it's just another forever commandment. And we could go look at Ezekiel. Well, we should. Is it just because we've done them all so far? Go get one from the prophets. You see why he did this? Why he has one from the Psalms, one from the prophets, and one from the writings. But Kings is actually prophets, so never mind. He has one from the Psalms and two from the prophets. Ezekiel. Okay, 37:24. This is a great prophecy. This may be the bomb of messianic prophecies, is Ezekiel 37. It starts off with the resurrection, the valley of the dry bones, and then we have the two sticks, Judah and Israel being united as the two sticks. And then we get into this very explicit material about what's going to happen in the messianic age. So here it goes. My servant David will be king over them. And you've got to remember, this is when he says David, this is Ben David, the son of David, the messianic king from the line of David. So my servant David will be king over them, and they will all have one shepherd, and they will walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes and observe them. So that's the first thing. When Messiah comes, everybody's going to walk in God's ordinances and keep his statutes and observe them. They will live on the land that I give to Jacob my servant, in which your fathers lived. They will live on it, they and their sons and their sons' sons forever, and David my servant will be their prince forever. I will make a covenant with peace with them. It will be an everlasting covenant, and I will place them and multiply them, and I will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. My dwelling place also will be with them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. And the nations will know that I am the Lord who sanctifies Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst forever. I say this is such an explosive messianic prophecy because it's saying that when God brings Israel back to the land and they're keeping the Torah and the temple is rebuilt, then everybody's going to see it. And they're going to realize that God has not forsaken his people Israel. So it will turn theological expectations upside down, the coming of Messiah, according to this passage. Okay. That's the passage he gives us. And then he wraps that section up with this conclusion. He says, if words have meaning, and if God means what he says, Jesus did not fulfill the law because the law is eternal. What's this mean? Well, we're talking about Matthew 5, right? Matthew 5:17? Yeah. Matthew 5:17. Do not think that I came to abolish or to do away with, to cancel the Torah. I did not come to abolish, to cancel the Torah. I came to fulfill the Torah. And the way that this passage, Matthew 5:17, is ordinarily taught within the church is, well, of course Jesus didn't cancel the law. He fulfilled it. He fulfilled it so that we don't have to, is the meaning. Now, this is, if you think this through a little bit, this is not a logical way to explain that particular passage, right? Because it's like he didn't cancel the law. He just canceled it. You know, I mean, right. Okay, so I've thought, let's, obviously Asher Norman has heard that line of reasoning. So let's just take a look. From a Jewish context, what does it mean that Jesus fulfilled the Torah? When he says, I came to fulfill, what does it mean? What does it mean to cancel the Torah? So I thought we'd take a look at a few references. I've got the Mishnah here, and I'm going to take you back to Pirkei Avot. I'm sorry I didn't get these on the sheet. I normally would put the rabbinic material on the sheet, but I had already printed these when I thought of doing this. And then, being an environmentally concerned person, I didn't want to print 25 more sheets of paper. I guess I could have put it on the back side, but that would have been confusing to you. Rabbi Yonatan Omer. So that's Rabbi Jonathan said, he who fulfills the Torah in poverty, sofo l'kayama me'asher. He will, in its end, he will fulfill it in wealth. He who fulfills the Torah in poverty. So he's like, I don't have any money, you know, I shouldn't be doing the mitzvah, but, you know, because it's too expensive, but I'm going to do it anyway. Eventually, he'll be able to fulfill the Torah in wealth. All right, so that's one. But then he goes on, he goes on to say, whoever neglects the Torah, mebatel, in wealth, will in the end, batla, neglect it, in poverty. So if a person's really wealthy, he says, you know, I don't have time for Torah, I have too much money to worry about doing a mitzvah, or however that might be. The money distracts us. He says, if that's the case, then in the end, you'll neglect it in poverty as well. So it's a nice little saying, but the only reason we're here is for these words. This is why I read it to you in Hebrew, is for the words. Mikayem, which is to fulfill. Mikayem. And batel. Mevatel is to abolish. You can remember batel because you maybe heard the Hasidic concept of betul, which is self-abnegation. Betul, I'm nothing. I'm now look who thinks he's nothing. You know that joke. Betul. So mebatel is to abolish or to completely abnegate, and mekayem is to fulfill. It's from kum, to stand upright. Okay? So these are the two words that our master probably used if he was speaking Hebrew. If he was speaking Aramaic, there'd be some sort of cognates of these words. Let me show you another passage since it's in the not too far away. Here's another one. If the Beit Din rendered a decision which voided an entire preceptive body, kol haguf, the whole body, saying something such as, there is no lav nidah in the Torah, or there is no Shabbat in the Torah, or there is no such thing as a prohibition of an idolatry in the Torah, then they are not liable for a sin offering. The Beit Din isn't. Because that's ridiculous. Nobody's gonna buy that. It's not even like you're not even in the same room with God here. However, if they gave a decision annulling part and sustaining part, then they are liable. How so? For example, regarding the Shabbat regarding the Nidah, if he cohabits with her while she maintains a day-to-day observation, regarding the Shabbat law in the Torah, if he carries from a private to a public area, idol worship, if he says idol worship is forbidding but merely bowing is not. So he's saying, you get the gist of the law. They're saying, if you say there's no such law in the Torah, that's not really a ruling of us. The Sanhedrin can't really rule that, so they wouldn't be liable for the sin offering. But if they made a mistake in a ruling. That's what Leviticus 4 is concerned about. All right. The only reason I brought you here is for these words again. It says, Horu levatel miktsat, if they taught to abolish from a part, a small part, ulkayem miktsat, or to keep, or to fulfill a small part. So, what does it mean? What does it mean to abolish and to fulfill? We're getting there.
Like the best thing we have to teach to the guard.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. What's the Hebrew?
It's lishmor lasot ulkayem.
Yeah, it's the same.
Et kol divrei Talmud Torah
tekabala. Yeah, excellent. Let's find some more examples, because this is I think this is interesting. So here's from got the Midrash Rabbah here. This is the advantage of having classes in the green room. We have all these books here. Midrash Rabbah, Genesis 55. I got my paperclip. Genesis 55:8. The children of Heth, it's written 10 times in the Torah. How much ink has been spilt and how many quills have been broken writing the children of Heth? These 10 correspond to the 10 commandments, teaching that if one assists a righteous man in his purchase of a burial ground, as is happens in that story in Chayei Sarah, it's as though he fulfilled the 10 commandments. Same word, fulfilled 10 commandments. Nikayim. Judan said the children of Barzillai is written 5 times. Children of Barzillai, children of Barzillai. Barzillai is the guy who met David when he was fleeing from Absalom across the Jordan, and he and his men were hungry and thirsty and tired, and Barzillai brought food. These 5 correspond to the 5 books of the Torah and teach that he who gives a piece of bread to the righteous is as though he had Nikayim, as though he had fulfilled the 5 books of the Torah. All right, so we're getting closer and closer here. I got one more. There's hundreds of these. This language is used all the time. But I've got one more I want to read because it's interesting. All right. Here, blessed be the omnipresent, Hamakom, that he identified himself with the early tzaddikim, the early righteous ones. Adam offered an ox on an altar, as it said, it shall please the Lord better than a bullock that divideth the hoof. Noah fulfilled that which is written in the Torah. So there's the word, fulfilled. As it is written, Noah built an altar to the Lord. You see, what they're saying is, these guys, how did they know this? The Torah hadn't been given yet. God didn't give the laws of sacrifice yet. But somehow, they fulfilled the Torah anyway. And so, it says, Abraham fulfilled the whole Torah, as it says, because that Abraham hearkened to my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. And he offered a ram as a sacrifice. Isaac fulfilled that which is written in the Torah, in that he cast himself before his father as a lamb to be sacrificed. You're supposed to be listening to these fulfilleds. Every time we use the word fulfilled, think, Mikayim. Jacob fulfilled that which is written in the Torah, as it is said, they gave unto Jacob all the foreign gods, so he took all the idols from his family and buried them. Judah fulfilled that which was written in the Torah, as it said, Judah said to Onan, go to thy brother's wife. So, the Levirate law that hadn't been given yet. Joseph fulfilled what is written in the Torah, as it is said, honor thy father, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. Joseph fulfilled all these. Even though unto them the Torah had not yet been given, they fulfilled it of their own accord. For this reason, the Holy One, blessed be He, loved them with a complete love, and made their name like unto His own great name. Of them He said, happy are they who are perfect in the way. And of Himself it is said, the rock, His work is perfect. And as for God, His way is perfect. Very nice midrash. Very nice, because not only does it perfectly illustrate mikayim and what it means to fulfill the Torah, but it also is, I remember when I first read this, I think it was my wife first read this midrash, and she read this to me. As like, this is a very good illustration, she said, this is years ago, you know, but she said, this is a very good illustration of what it is to, you know, to be a Gentile believer, you know, doing Torah. You know, that you say, well, why am I doing the Sabbath? Well, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they didn't even given the commandments either. But they fulfilled, it says, all the commandments. They fulfilled all the commandments. What does it mean to have fulfilled? When Yeshua says, I did not come to abolish the Torah. I came to mechayim. I came to fulfill the Torah. It's to obey, to keep. Every reference we've seen so far. And there's also another aspect, not just to obey and to keep, but there's a secondary aspect in that we saw that a Sanhedrin, or teachers, who incorrectly interpret a law of the Torah, are abolishing it, mavatel. But teachers who are correctly legislating on the Torah are mikayim. So it has both meanings. On the one hand, Messiah has come to keep the Torah, to be sinless, to be righteous, to be a total tzaddik, 100% righteous person. On the other hand, he came to correctly interpret the Torah. And if you think about the context of Matthew 5:17, he is about to launch into the greatest Torah sermon ever delivered. He's just after he says that. So I think you have to see both. In any case, the one thing that mikayim and fulfilled does not mean is abolish. It doesn't mean cancel or done away with. I remember the first time that I saw that, I really like came face to face with this. Do you remember when the internet was new and kind of exciting? And you first got the internet, and I went out, like the very first thing that I like typed in, you know, looking on a search engine, was for messianic Jewish sites. You know, immediately wanted like message in a bottle. Is there anybody out there? Out there, you know. So sure enough, I found a chat room. Have you ever been in a chat room? Okay, so this was, and the title of the chat room was Messianic Judaism. So I went in, and you know, it was just, this is my first internet experience. And so I think my wife and I were kind of like just curious, you know, what's going on. And I asked, you know, if there was anyone Torah observant in this chat room. And the conversation quickly spiraled from that comment, and immediately the thing started to churn, you know. But the response I got was, no, you know, why would you do that? Why would you put yourself under the law? Jesus fulfilled the law so that we don't have to. So this is like, things haven't really changed that much. I mean, that was, what, 10 years ago? I don't know. Something like that. Probably longer. But things have not changed that much in the Messianic movement in general. That is still the general consensus of Messianic Judaism. It's still certainly the consensus of Christianity. So even if we feel like we can sit in this room and we can all like agree and say, well, Jesus didn't cancel the Torah, check it out. Everybody else thinks he did. So this is not just academic. We're not just repeating things in vain.
There's another definition of mikayem is like maybe even establish or endure.
Yeah.
Fulfills, people get the, maybe it might be the wrong idea, but yeah.
I know it's establish is probably, it depends on context, yeah, of how you would use that. But a good example is the David Melech Israel song.
Yeah.
David Melech Israel, Chai Chai Vikayim. David, King of Israel, lives, and endures. Not lives, and fulfills. But so establish is probably an even better translation than fulfill. The Torah will be in effect in the messianic future. We already saw that Ezekiel 37:25 verse. We don't need to go there. And the Isaiah 2:3 verse is simply Kimitzion, Tetzei Torah. In that day, the Torah will go out from Jerusalem, the word of the Lord from Zion, and all the nations are going to come up to the house of God, and they'll all be singing, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord," and they're all going to go up to the house of God in Jerusalem, and God's and the Messiah is going to teach the Torah, and the Torah is going to go out to the nations, and it is the most beautiful prophecy of the Messianic era. Then they'll beat their swords into plowshares, and they won't learn war anymore because Messiah will judge between the nations. It's a beautiful prophecy. But the point of the prophecy is that the Torah is going to be a universal law in the Messianic era. And so Asher Norman's point is, wait a second. If the Messiah is going to come and establish the Torah, then what kind of Messiah comes and abolishes the Torah? Yeah, okay. So he gives us one more. He says, and he titles it this way. He says, God's final message to the Jews through the prophet Malachi. So let's go look at God's final message to the Jews. Now, why would he call it that? You're going to be in Malachi 4, verse 4 in a Christian published Bible. Malachi 4, 4. Why does he call it God's final message to the Jews? Yeah, it comes at the end of the Tanakh. And it comes at the end of the prophetic era. In Judaism, the belief is that the Holy Spirit of prophecy did not rest on the second temple as it had on the first. And so prophets ceased after the destruction of the first temple. And there's a precious few who were maybe babies when the first temple was destroyed, and they continued on into the second temple era. But after a certain point, there just were no more prophets like the good old days. And so that's Malachi's the last of the last. Now, in apostolic tradition, John carries on the prophetic tradition. Carries on the prophetic tradition, and then the prophetic tradition is passed to the believers with the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. But that's another matter. So our point here is, let's just imagine ourselves in the New Testament era, and we have this idea that maybe the prophetic era really is over, and has been for a couple hundred years. But we have the Tanakh. We have the words of the prophets. Who's the last of them? Malachi. What's the last thing he told us? It's like God, it's like, okay, I'm not going to talk to you now for several centuries. Here's the last thing I'm leaving with you. Malachi 4:4. Remember the Torah of Moses my servant, even the statutes and ordinances which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel. And then here's a messianic promise. Behold, I am going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. He will restore the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, so that I will not come and smite the land with a curse. All right, that's it. Last message. Keep the Torah. I'm sending Elijah. He'll get you ready for Messiah. All right, fine. Asher Norman points out, says Christian theology requires one to believe that the very next thing God did after this prophecy, after sending Malachi to remind the Jewish people to keep the commandments, was to send Jesus to tell the Jewish people not to keep the commandments. Mm-hmm. So you end up with this schizophrenic picture of God, you know? It's like this kind of what's the word? Capricious. Capricious. Keep the commandments. Keep the commandments. If you don't, I'll send you into exile. I'll give you all sorts of nasty curses. In fact, a whole chapter of curses and so on. And then you come to the end of that, and he's like, ah, forget it. No, don't. In fact, don't keep the commandments. Don't keep the commandments. New plan here. All right. Good point, Mr. Norman. Reason number four that Jews don't believe in Jesus. The Torah says that man may not add to or diminish from the laws of the Torah. Okay, it does. However, Asher Norman says, Christian missionaries claim that the commandments originally were binding, but they have been fulfilled, quote unquote, diminished, made optional, or terminated by Jesus' atoning death, and therefore no longer lead to salvation. Okay, so last week we said that there's a little bit of a problem with the concept of lead to salvation, with Mr. Norman's idea that how do you keep the commandments, or how do you get saved? You keep the commandments. That's salvation is by keeping the commandments. Not really a Jewish idea. The Jewish idea is that you're saved because you're in covenant with God. And you keep the commandments as part of that covenant with God. So you keep the commandments to maintain, I guess you could say from a Jewish perspective, a covenant relationship. But that's not what saves you. God's grace to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the children of Israel is ultimately what saves. Jewish perspective. So not quite correct to say commandments lead to salvation. Nevertheless, the rest of the statement is correct. That Christian missionaries claim that the commandments originally were binding. So every Christian missionary would tell you that. If you said to a Christian theologian, would it have been a sin for King David to eat ham? Well, of course. Of course, that, you know. Okay, but let's say, you know, would it be a sin for Timothy in the New Testament to eat ham? Well, no. Well, both are Jewish. They're both Jewish people. You know? So what changed here? Well, Jesus' atoning death and resurrection is what changed. And so we've improved the situation. Let's look at Psalm 19. He wants us to. I think this is, you know, this study, what we're learning here tonight, is something that we really know pretty well. This is not new material for us. We know this stuff pretty well. Not really controversial for us. But maybe sometimes we forget just how big and how profound this is. What a huge disconnect there is here. Psalm 19, beginning in verse 8. No, we'll start in 7. The Torah of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. That's where we're supposed to start. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making the wise simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true, they are righteous altogether. So Asher Norman just wants us to see the Torah of the Lord is perfect. And he says, perfection cannot be improved. So the Torah is either perfect or it's not perfect. The Bible says it's perfect. So if it's perfect, then you can't improve upon it. All right, good point. And then he goes on to say, the Bible says that laws may not be increased or decreased. And he gives us two citations from Deuteronomy 4 and Deuteronomy 12. What are they? We'll look up the. Let's go to the Deuteronomy 4 one. Deuteronomy 4:2. You shall not add to the word which I am commanding you, nor take away from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. Simple enough. We could go look at the 12, but it says pretty much the same thing in Deuteronomy 12. You shall not add, you shall not take away. Now, there's sort of an interesting challenge that this verse always brings up. This verse always brings up this, two objections. On the one hand is the objection, well, obviously Christian theology is taking away a lot of Torah. He's saying it's canceled. you're taken away. You're like that Sanhedrin that said, there's no Sabbath in the Torah. You're not even in the same room. We're not even talking in the same language. But on the other hand, what about adding to the Torah? So there's an objection that often comes up where we say, well, look at the rabbis. They added so much to the Torah. I mean, look at this. This book's only this big. Look at all those books. That's obviously, there's a lot of adding going on. in some cases, I think the sages would plead guilty to that. I know they do. In a few cases, they say, you know what? We made that up. Such as, I can think of one example is the ability to annul vows, that a rabbinic court can annul vows. The Talmud says, this is hanging by a thread. This is not really something that's biblical. A father has the right to annul his daughter's vows and his wife's vows as soon as he hears about them. And so they inferred from that, well, a father is in authority over his wife and his daughter. The rabbis are in authority over their congregation. Therefore, the rabbis have authority to annul their congregants' vows. Adding to the Torah, sort of. Really just spinning off of a commandment that's already there. But it's interesting to me because this is one of the ones that the sages say, yeah, we made that up. But it's one of the ones that appears in the New Testament as well. The master says to the disciples, I give you the authority to bind and to loose, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. That's the same thing. It's the same language. So, there's one. Hanukkah is another. I remember reading Hanukkah. Not the festival itself, because that's not a mitzvah, but the idea that lighting Hanukkah lights is a mitzvah is added. So there's a bracha that goes with, a blessing that goes when you light the Hanukkah lights, who sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us to light the lights of Hanukkah. Okay, so the Talmud says in Tractate Shabbat or Sanhedrin, it starts with an S anyway, says, where are we commanded to light Hanukkah lights? And so then the sage that answers it says, well, we're not. But you're commanded to obey the sages, and I'm commanding you to light the Hanukkah lights. So there is sort of that. There is a little bit of that going on, for sure. But for the most part, most of the things that we, on the outside of Judaism, would look at and say, oh, they made that up. They added that to the Torah. Is actually not. Instead, it's an interpretation of an existing law of the Torah. For example, you might say that they made up the law about you can't turn on lights on Sabbath or turn on or off a light switch on Sabbath. No, they didn't make up the law. The law is keep the Sabbath. The question is, what does that mean and how is that played out? So the law is do not work. The question is, what constitutes work? So it's not quite so simple. But
kindling
the fire, that's one of the explanations, yeah, for that.
Well, that's a Torah command. Don't kindle a fire on the Sabbath.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not to kindle a fire on the Sabbath. Okay, so adding, but yeah, there's a, I mean, this is not, I'm not gonna lie to you and say that there's not, like, stuff that's over the top that's been added, you know, but I guess we can both plead guilty. to the break in Deuteronomy 4:2 a little bit. All right, so God will not change his mind, Asher Norman says. So he gives us Numbers chapter 23, verse 19, which is in the prophecies of Balaam, where Balaam says, God is not a man that he should lie, nor is the son of man that he should change his mind or repent or something like that. And then 1 Samuel 15:29, the exact same kind of language where Samuel announces to King Saul that he's going to lose the kingdom because of his disobedience. And Saul says, oh, please, 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 please. And Samuel says, God is not a man or a son of man that he will repent or change his mind. He's not going to change his mind. He's already made up his mind on this. He's not going to change his mind. So these two texts are cited to establish a very simple principle that you shouldn't even need text in order to establish. And that is that God is not capricious. God is not changing. If he is, then, yeah, maybe he could, like, say, you're my people, now you're not. Keep the Torah, now don't. Which should be very frightening if that was God, you know, because it's like, well, if God changed the program there, who says he hasn't changed the program in the last 2,000 years? How do we know that the Muslims aren't right? You know? Or pick your religion. You would, there'd be no foundation for faith whatsoever if God could capriciously change his mind. And he would, he couldn't lecture us much about integrity then either. If God could make a promise or make a statement and then alter it. Yes. When we read about the covenant, you know, it's God behind this covenant, even more so then, it's the unchanging God behind this covenant. This is forever. What we're talking about is this is forever. So, I don't know how we could have come to how we could have arrived at the opposite meaning of the Bible. You know, it's an amazing thing to me. Anyway, he sums this point up by saying, God's law is perfect, trustworthy, upright, and clear. The Torah says that man may not add to or subtract from the law. God is not a man that he should lie or relent, change his mind. 2 points, well taken. Reason number 3 and reason number 4. Are they legitimate reasons for why Jews don't believe in Jesus? Yes, they are, absolutely. Because the Jesus that the Jewish world knows is the Jesus that topples the Torah, that he does away with the Torah. Yes?
I just don't understand it, though. Because if in 5 minutes you can figure out what fulfilled...
Any rabbinic scholar could look at that text and tell you what Jesus meant.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But what Asher Norman is doing is he's not looking at Jesus and interpreting Jesus. He is simply returning what he has received from Christian interpretation. In the next chapter, reason number 5 is called Jesus versus the Torah. And his first point is Jesus both affirmed and opposed the laws in the Torah. And so he is going to go deeper with it. And look at this, and so this is where it really starts to get interesting. In reason number 5, because we're going to look at troubling passages regarding Torah and the Gospel, and then reason number 6, very simply stated, why Jews don't believe in Jesus. Jesus was a false prophet. we'll look at some. We'll look at the claims of prophecies that he made that have not panned out. Like, for example, you won't finish going through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. As the class goes on, it gets harder and harder. But